I'm Julie, I'm an addict.
Hi, Julie.
Very nervous. I always swore I'd never do a chair at this meeting. And the request came in when I was sitting with a fella I wanted to impress. So I said, look, I've been asked to do this. And he goes, you're going to do it, aren't you? I went, yeah. And then I thought, oh my God, another thing I said I'd do. I really didn't want to do, but it's service, isn't it? And I am really, really nervous. But what has slightly cheered me up is I don't think anyone here has heard my chair before. So I can go back to tried and trusted, and I can tell the same jokes, and I don't have to be brand new right from the start because I'm worried I'm going to bore someone or that so-and-so heard me Tuesday. There's none of that. I don't think anyone has heard me before, so that's cool. Just to start, I like to do things chronologically, really. Start at the beginning, isn't it? My story's got a beginning and a middle, and I'm not at the end yet. And I was born in London. I was born at St. Thomas's Hospital. And 25 years later, I was scripted at the DDU, the Drug Dependency Unit, in that same hospital, because I had a heroin habit I couldn't shake. To my horror, I couldn't shake it. And I always thought of that heroin habit as, when I got into recovery, I thought of that heroin habit as the second best thing that ever happened to me. The first best thing was stopping, coming to recovery, coming into NA. But the second best thing was getting that heroin habit, because it told me very clearly that I was an addict. And before, I'd been bouncing along on cannabis and pills and bits and bobs of powder. And I think I could have gone on for years and years like that, but heroin told me a story, this is who you are. And I was very grateful once I'd come into recovery. And to start again, I'm a Londoner, I was born, I'm the eldest of, there's almost eight of us really. My father got married three times. And I was born into a family where people were very unhappy. You know, and the currency of communication was always resentment and blame. And you're not good enough and you don't fit in. And it was difficult. It was difficult growing up, and it was difficult for all of us. You know, not all of us turned out to be addicts. Some of us turned out to be bankers, you know, and some of us turned out to be psychos. But I was one of the addict crew, and some of us are dead of this illness, and I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm one of the very lucky ones. And throughout my childhood, all I felt was alone and different and disconnected and wrong. I felt wrong. And nothing worked for me. I didn't like being female. I wanted to be a boy. I didn't like being white. I wanted to be black. I was so not happy in my own skin. And by the time I was sort of 12 or 13, I was desperate. I thought, where is this happiness? You know, I could not work out how to get happy. Where is it? How do you get happy? And so I tried working really hard at school and winning every prize going and achieving. That still didn't make me happy. And so the next step was drugs and drink. I couldn't see any other way, really and truly. And when I tried drugs and drink, didn't like them either, to be honest with you. Didn't like them at all. So, you know, nothing was working for me at the age of 14. Absolutely nothing was working for me. And I wound up getting expelled from the school I was at, which had turned into a battle between me and my teachers. And they put me in detention every single day. And I'd do my detention and then I'd kick up more trouble. And then the next day I'd be in detention again. And finally I got tossed out. But because my report was so bad, there was only one school in the country that would take me, and that was down in Devon. And half that school are now in the fellowship, you know. And the only school rule was no skateboarding and lessons. Besides that, everything was cool. And I didn't know how to be happy, but my friends in that school kind of taught me how to kind of be happy. But also my drug use just went berserk. You know, as soon as I was out of home, away from the parents and the stepmother that I hated, my drug use was just phenomenal. You know, someone would have a handful of pills and I would just put my face in and just take, scarf everything up. There was no question of asking what they were or taking one or two. It's a whole lot for me, head first in, and scrumpy at the time was 6p a pint. So I would scrounge 2p off three different people and then go and get a pint of scrumpy and then go and get more. And then kick off. And my first major blackout, I managed to disgrace myself, and I'd got drunk, I'd got stoned. It was a boarding school, and I decided to get on the roof of the school with, fire hose, and I switched it on, and I set all the fire alarms off. And when all the teachers came running to see what was going on, I soaked them up with the fire hose, and then I ran for cover so they couldn't find me. I was like going under people's beds, hiding, and they did eventually catch me. And I didn't really know what I was doing. I was in blackout, you know. I remember stubbing a cigarette out in my eye, and I woke up the next morning with my shoes on in bed, and I thought, this is a bad sign. What has happened? And I walked into breakfast, and there's this big hall. I can still see them now. They go, oh, Julie, do you know what you did last night? I went, no, not for the first time. You know, it was the first time. No, I didn't know what I'd done, but they told me. And they didn't really punish me, so I started to kind of calm down. But I was fitting in, and I was trying to control my using, and I was working hard for my A-levels, because I wanted to be someone, because I had two grandmothers. One was a morphine addict, one was an alcoholic, and I knew I didn't want to be like them. And so I was trying to control my using, and I came out of that school at 17 and did a gap year in London, got a flat in Knightsbridge, got a job, started taking heroin. And the first time I took heroin, I was given it. I can still remember the address and the postcode of where I was at. It was in Bassett Road, Ladbroke Grove. And I'd never felt anything like it. You know, just all of a sudden I was secure and safe, and there was like this duvet wrapped around me. Everything was okay. It was going to be okay. First time I'd ever felt anything like that, you know. And I'd had no idea up to that point what feeling good really was, and the heroin gave me that. But then, you know, I got scared of that too. I knew I didn't want to get a habit, and so I would, and my friend I was living with would say to me, what are you doing? You look dreadful, stop it. And so I'd put the heroin down, and I'd go back to dope, I'd go back to alcohol, I'd go back to pills from the doctor. And the next, so 8 years were like that. I would jump from taking tons of heroin and then getting very scared, and I would stop it, and I would go back to all the other drugs, and then I would go back on heroin, and then I would stop it. So, and in the middle of all this, I decided it would be a good idea to have kids and get married. I thought this would sort me out. And so I wound up, I had two little boys. The first boy I was absolutely delighted that I was pregnant with, and I got married to the father. I think I was the very last person to think if you got pregnant, you had to get married. I don't think anyone else thought that after me, but I thought, you get pregnant, you get married. So I got married, and and with the second boy, I had no idea I was pregnant until I was about 6 months gone, and I was walking across Blackheath with my sister, and she said to me, Julie, you're pregnant, your trousers don't fit, you can't do them up. I said, really? I was so stoned, I had no idea I was pregnant, absolutely no idea at all. And at that point, we were living in Plumstead in a house I hated, in an area I hated, with a husband I hated, and I was smoking tons of cannabis and drinking, and I was absolutely gone. I was really, really gone. With the first one, I'd managed to put all the drugs down. With the second one, I was gone. I was out of control. The illness was running the show, and the illness was making the decisions. And so by that point, I think I was only about 21, something like that. I was very young, and I was doing what, I was desperately trying to find a life for myself, you know, and desperately trying to find a family for myself and a role and who I was and how could I function. Because I kept thinking, I was born in the wrong century. I don't understand this. I can't work a video machine. And And when we went to the cinema, we would go and see, like, the Harrison Ford films, you know, the Steven Spielberg films, Raiders of the Lost Ark, that's it. And I'd say to my eldest boy, why is he doing that, you know? And my eldest, who would be like 3 or 4 at the time, would explain what was going on in the film. And 5 minutes later, I thought, I still don't fucking understand this, right? What's going on, Harry? And I was absolutely clueless. And I used to walk around Greenwich, which is where we were living at the time, feeling really desperate. And there used to be a big tramp who would also walk around Greenwich at the same time. And one day he looked at me as we passed for like the 4th time in that day. He said, I'm so sick of seeing you. And I'd never forgotten that. And then I'm like, oh, okay. And then what happened? I got a ton of money. How did I get a ton of money? I can't remember how I got a ton of money. For me, it was a ton of money. And I thought, oh yeah, I remember how I got it. Okay, anyway, that's another story. But I had $8,000. It was a ton of money at the time, and I thought, it's time, party time. So I phoned up this dealer and I said to him, I want X of cocaine and I want X of heroin. And I mentioned the cocaine first. I didn't even want the cocaine. I was always heroin. It was heroin that I wanted, but I wanted to hide that from myself. Yeah. And he came round and the $8,000 went in just like a couple of months max. I don't know. And then I thought I could do what I always did, which is put it down and go back to cannabis and drink. And I couldn't put it down. Could not stop, and I still remember the kick in the guts. I'm hooked, I can't stop. I'm caught, I've got to have it, I'm a junkie. I have to get out of bed and I have to go shoplifting and I have to do this and I have to do that because I have to have my heroin because I can't stop. Mentally, I was utterly obsessed. The compulsion had me. And I still remember that compulsion as being one of the very worst things ever in my life. It's just vile, I'm so glad I haven't got that compulsion today. So I spent the next X years doing all the crap that we do to get money, to get gear, getting ripped off, getting signed on at the DDU, where they really upset me. They said to me, we want to sign you on for methadone for life. I went, no, absolutely no. No, I said, no, I'm better than that, no. And what I thought I wanted, I did not want. You know, I did not want that. But I had no way out. I just didn't know what to do. And people were like, you know, why can't you stop? I can't. Why can't you? I can't. I can't stop. And then one day I was at home and there was a knock on the door and this girl called Charlotte was there. And I was at school with Charlotte. And then after we left school, we used together. We did credit cards together. She had a motorbike. We'd ride around on that. She was godmother to my 2 kids, and I hadn't seen her for a while. Anyway, there she was at the door. And she looked really well. All the spots had gone, and she was glowing. And she said to me, well, if Muhammad won't come to the mountain, you know, the mountain must come to Muhammad. I always remember her saying that. I must have been ignoring her phone calls. And said, come in. We went upstairs and she didn't want to go to the pub. She didn't want to go up the road to Andy, the dealers. She didn't want a joint. She didn't want anything. And I looked at her with absolute astonishment because all I'd ever heard was people chatting shit. Like, oh, you know, I'm going into this mental hospital and I'm going to clean up. And then a week later they were back scoring again. That's all I'd ever seen. But there was Charlotte not taking anything in front of me and looking good. And I'd known her, you know, we'd been mates for years, and we'd had a mate who died of a heroin overdose, age 17, Natalia, and we always swore we'd never be like Natalia, and of course we were like Natalia, but we weren't dead yet. And I said to her, how did you do it? And I now know that was the really operative phrase, how did you do it? I know when I hear that from other people, that is a good sign. We can kind of plow ahead with recovery. And she went to me, oh, I went into a treatment centre, you can too. I went, no, you know. And then a week later, I was in so much trouble with my boyfriend for having pulled a really nasty stunt, which to my astonishment, he knew it was me. And the pressure was on and I rang Charlotte. I said, get me out of here, get me into that treatment centre. And I'd imagined it would be a week or two in London. Turned into 8 weeks in Wiltshire. And I was put on a train, I had my clothes in a black bin bag, I had a raving headache. I sat on the floor. I couldn't even sit on the seat. I was like head down, and it was like, oh, another stupid thing I've said I'll do when I'm stoned, another one. And I got to this treatment centre, and they were nice to me. You know, it had been a long time since people had been nice to me. I think it had been 10 years since anyone had actually been warm and kind and loving to me. So that was kind of seductive in itself. And then we started on the steps, you know. We started on step one. And step one, I wouldn't say I've always been good at. I do understand. Because of my drugs history, I understood that I was powerless over everything. I couldn't take anything at all. I was a bit surprised when they mentioned alcohol. I thought they were having a laugh, really and truly, for a good few weeks. But then it began to sink in, particularly when I wrote my life story and I wrote my step one. Because alcohol was always bottom of my list of what I wanted. I always wanted drugs, particularly drugs I could smoke. But it was always there on a daily basis. I could tell you stories about 100 pubs in South London where I'd done this or I'd done that. I'd been in the pubs, I'd been drinking, and I'd been necking it to kill the pain. And I'd been down the newsagents to get my bottles of vodka, you know, and down the chemist to get my methadone. And so I understood I was powerless over absolutely everything. Absolutely everything. That I couldn't smoke dope. I couldn't go home and do that. And then step two and step three, they were very insistent on getting a higher power. Okay. Me having a higher power. They wanted it to be a god. And I was a bit resistant to God because I couldn't imagine any kind of a loving, caring God. How could that be possible? You know, my family life had not been loving and caring. My marriage had not been loving and caring. My relationship with the boyfriend that followed had not been loving and caring. This whole kind of concept was weird. You know, I'd be more likely to believe in aliens, really and truly, than that. But they went on and on and on at me. And finally, I said, all right, I'll buy it. If you tell me it will help, I will have this God that floats around up here that I can talk to. And I will have another higher power that will be the fellowship and the meetings and the steps and the rooms. I'll have every sort of higher power you can imagine. And I didn't realise at the time, but I do now, looking back, that was when the compulsion and obsession to use left me. And it's never come back. It's never, ever come back. And it's never come back, and it was step two and step three that took it away from me. And that was in the summer of 1985. And I came out of treatment. I did 8 weeks, came back to London, and I realised I had to change all my playmates. Mm-hmm. Couldn't hang around with the old bunch anymore. I went to the pub with them. I was like, 8 weeks treatment had really changed me. I was like horrified, you know. Thought, no, no, no. And I felt terribly scared that I had to start again. Had to make all new friends. They was really lonely. But I knew the only way was forwards. And what I'd always done was, for recovery, I've always been good at one day at a time. I always take the view that I pray in the morning, I ask to be kept clean. Anything I want to do well, I ask my higher power for help with, because on my own, I wind up in a lot of trouble. Even in recovery, I wind up in a lot of trouble. So the first 5 years of recovery, I actually worked quite a good program. I did one day at a time. Worked really hard, tried to get everything together, went to loads of meetings, did loads of fellowship. Always think fellowship after the meeting is really, really important. Make your friends, get your friends so you can talk to them. And in the evening. And I've had some really strange experiences in recovery. And I've had proper higher power experiences. And I've had proper taking my will back experiences as well, which I just wouldn't recommend. I'll start with a higher power. I was sitting in Charlton, which is where we were living, which was like, I was the furthest east of any recovering addict. The nearest one to me was in the Pepys Estate in Surrey Docks, Paul. And there were no NA meetings around there, so I would come up to town for the NA meetings, and then locally I would go to the other fellowship. And And there was no mobile phones, obviously. And my landline had been cut off years before for non-payment, but the phone was still sitting on the table in the front room. And about 8 months in, the loneliness began to get very dark. You know, the isolation and the I'm on my own, and what is the flipping point? Just the pain started to rise, and at which point the phone started to ring. And I looked at it and I picked it up, and there's some stranger going, blah, 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 blah. And I'm going, no, put the phone down. And I pick it up, it's working. So I rang my mate from treatment and I said, get my number for me. I can't remember how she did it, but she did it. She rang me back, this is your number. And I had a phone, which I never got a bill for. And it saved me, it absolutely saved me. And about 18 months later, we were on like a first floor flat. Look out the window, there's the top of some fella's head, he's up a ladder. I'm thinking, he's disconnecting my phone, the fucker. And he was, but I had the money to get it put back on at that point. And that was, I've had all sorts of very odd things happen that have been very good, where I've been saved in the nick of time by stuff I could never have predicted has come in and rescued me. Because I tend to think I know everything. I'm not a humble person in any way, shape or form. You know, but I don't know everything. All sorts can happen in recovery. And after X years of really working a program quite well, I suddenly decided to take my will and my life back, and really wouldn't recommend it at all. And I didn't think of it as I was taking my will and my life back. What I thought was, I know what I'm doing now. That lot have been really helpful, but I now want normal friends. Honestly, this is what I was thinking. I'm going to have normal friends and a normal boyfriend, right? I can't tell you what a fuck up that turned into. Oh, I couldn't tell you. It'd be so, oh dear. And I got this idea that I could do whatever I wanted as long as I didn't pick up. And I really wasn't going to many meetings at all. Occasionally I was popping into the other fellowship. Wasn't working a program of recovery. Didn't want to use. Was still clean and sober. But I was running my own life. I was under my own will. I got into such a lot of trouble. Even to put it, my addiction was alive, even though I wasn't using, it was alive. And I think of addiction as we are living in a house that's on fire, and the fire's there all the time, you know. And you might have a big house and the fire's in a room, you know, yards and yards away, and like, it's just like coals, burning coals, yeah? You can't really see any flames, but it's there. It's there all the time, never goes away. The house is always on fire. And if you let that fire, if you let the flames come up, the smoke comes under the door of the room you're sitting in. And that's what happened to me. The smoke came under the door of the room I was sitting in. And I was the last person to be aware that addiction was coming in and taking me over yet again, even without drugs, even without drink. And I acted out in all sorts of ways during that period of time. I mean, one example would be coffee. I got it into my head that it's absolutely normal to drink 15 triple espressos a day. Yeah, if I want it, it's normal. That's what I thought about. And I got really ill. I was in the doctors regularly. I was getting treatment. This went on for about a year. And during this year, I was coming back to meetings. And there was this young guy. He kept popping up. He would say to me, Julie, can I tell you about how I've stopped drinking tea and coffee? I'd say, no, you can't, because you're boring me. I don't want to know about Twinings herbal tea. Yeah. It's nothing to do with me. I'm here for drugs and drink. I don't care. And every meeting I went to, this young fella would pop his head up. Can I tell you about how I've given up caffeine? No, I'd say, no, because I really can't. I don't come here to be bored. And then it turned out this really serious, unpleasant illness I had was all to do with the coffee I was drinking. I stopped drinking completely, and the illness cleared up like that. So one day, it was gone. And then I realised that my ideas of what was normal were not normal at all. And I never saw that young fella again. The minute I stopped drinking coffee and got well, never saw him. I've not seen him since. And I would have said to him, you were right. But it just shows me how God sends messengers, and I'm going, no, go away. Really don't want to hear anything from what you're saying, because I was a bit up myself, really. I thought I knew better. But I was proper ill for a year. And I got into all sorts when I was running my own program, running myself. And I wound up, I had a flat. By that point, I was quite well off. I'd come from like a housing association flat in Charlton. It had took me 8 years to get any kind of money at all. But I wound up quite well off. I never thought I was going to be well off. But I wound up, I had a flat in the Barbican, which is a nice place to live. I had the boyfriend I'd always wanted. Had a house in the country, had two Mercedes, had a job. And then it started to unravel. And I wound up, I lost a lot. It all went. And I wound up having 6 months in hospital as well. I got physically very, very ill. And when I came out, my truth was that my normal friends, normal boyfriend, weren't there for me. When the shit hit the fan, they were not there. But I tell you who was, people from the fellowship, they were there, including people I hadn't seen for 10 years. They were there. And they helped me rebuild. And it was, what, 5 years ago since I came out of hospital? I'm not sure. And proper ill I was, and quite gutted by what had happened, but able to see that me taking my will and my life back, I'd set myself up for all this loss, you know, and all this grief and all this disappointment. The truth of the matter now is I'm all right, I'm fine. I haven't got resentments against the ex-boyfriend or against the ex-friends. If they were in hospital, I'd go and visit them. And I'm okay with where I live now. It's not the Barbican. I think I like it even more because I've got the river. I like my fellowship friends. I'm healthy at the moment. And what I've learnt, because I've now been in recovery, whether I've been working a program or not, and now I'm working a program much harder, really, than I have done ever since the early years. You know, if you want to make God laugh, tell him you're making plans for your life, you know, because you just don't know what's going to happen. And the safest way to be, I always used to hate that phrase, get in the middle of the bed, but the safest way to be is working the steps in the program, working, you know, with the fellowship, to not let the demons back in, because I still live in a house on fire. That fire still burns. It can still kill me. And, you know, and I've seen quite a lot of people come and go. Really quite a lot of people come and go. And I don't want to be one of them. And back to working one day at a time. At the moment, I wake up in the morning, say my prayers, read the Just for Today, and then I'm on my WhatsApp group and I'm texting people. I'm connecting, because if I connect with the fellowship, and then I connect with myself. And I cannot connect with myself until I connect with the fellowship. You lot are my vehicle for me to feel whole, for me to feel like a person who belongs in their own skin. Without you lot, I drift into absolute disaster, you know. And so I connect with everyone. And I'm adding new people all the time who I connect with. And then I get out and I do my day. And bad stuff happens, you know, still bad stuff happens. I've got two sons, they're both fellowship boys. One's still clean and sober, the other one's on a relapse. The second one who's on a relapse texted me at 4 in the morning never want to see you again, you're not my mother anymore, this is Wednesday. I was like already awake, yeah, he'd clearly been up all night smoking dope, yeah, with this like long, long text message he whacked over to me. And I just whacked one back. Yeah, I understand, son, I'm sorry for this, I'm sorry for that. Door's always open, get in touch, lots of love, mum. And, because anything can happen. Things change. Things change, he might pop up in a week or so. I'm not gonna go down. You know, because I just take the view, one day at a time, one day there won't be another day. So I'm happy. You know, I've finally got there. And, because I focus on the positive, and also I focus on what I can give rather than what I can get. Because for years in recovery, I thought, what can I get? You know? And now I realize that I've got it all back to front. I'm only happy if I'm actually giving to other people. And this is the way I have to be. This is the way I'm built. I am built to fit into the fellowship and the program and work it to the best of my ability, because without that, I don't function at all. And I haven't gone into detail about lots of the stuff I got up to when I took my will and my life back, but I'm sure you can imagine I got into all sorts of trouble, and I wound up ringing one of the guys from the fellowship saying, I need a lawyer, get me a lawyer. And I feel very grateful to still be here. And very grateful I'm not living in resentment, I'm not living in compulsion, I'm not living in self-pity, I'm not living in negativity. I've got people I really like that I'm not foolish enough to trust normal people, because the normal people I picked to be friends with, they weren't normal at all. They were absolute flipping psychos. And I always wanted to be safe, and now I do feel I'm safe. You know, I feel I'm in a safe place. And I try and think of something sort of okay to end on. I don't know. I heard this at a meeting recently, and anything I hear in a meeting, it belongs to me, because we share here. We don't keep it to ourselves. You know, anything I hear that I think that's good, it belongs to me now. And what was said was, you know, we don't come here to get, we come here to give. And that is what works for us, we come here to give. And on that note, I think I'm going into waffle. I'm going to end now. Thank you very much.